16. The timeship came to rest in an enclosed courtyard paved with cobblestones. Parsons, as he stepped from the ship, saw the iron railings of vaulted balconies, damp foliage of plants, and then Loris led him through a doorway and along a deserted corridor. "This part of the lodge," she said over her shoulder to him, "is mine, so you don't need to worry. No one will interfere with us." Soon he lay in a bathtub of hot water, his head against the porcelain side, eyes shut, enjoying the smell of soap and the peace and silence of the room. Almost at once the door opened and Loris entered with an armload of washcloths and towels.
"Sorry to bother you,"
she said, folding a fluffy white bath towel over a rack on the wall. He did not answer. He did not even open his eyes.
"You're tired,"
she said. Lingering, she said,
"I know now why none of our signal markers reached you."
At that, he opened his eyes.
"That first trip you took," she said, "to the far future, when you didn't know how to operate the ship."
"What happened to the markers?" she said.
"Helmar destroyed them."
"Why?" he said, wide awake. Brushing her long black hair from her eyes, she said calmly,
"We sought any possible way to break the chain at some point. You understand, very few of us have any well-disposed feelings toward you."
She hesitated, considering him as he lay in the tub.
"Odd," she said, "to have you back here. You're going to spend the night with me, aren't you?"
He said, "So Helmar did what he could to leave me trapped in the future," he thought. "It was not bad enough for me back in the past in Nova Albion." Recalling the desolate plains of the future, his body and mind recoiled, and they had done their best. If it had not been for the plaque. Abruptly, he said,
"And he tried to find the granite plaque, too?"
"He searched," Loris said, "but he failed to find it. There was some doubt in our minds, quite a bit in Helmar's, that there ever was any plaque. All the signal markers were located. There was no real trouble in doing that, since we knew exactly where they were and how many we had sent out. Helmar returned, but it made no difference. My father," she shrugged, her arms folded, "it had no effect on him."
After his bath, he dried himself. He shaved and then, putting on a silk robe that Loris had presented to him, came out of the bathroom. On a chair in the corner of the bedroom, Loris sat curled up, her feet bare. She wore Chinese coolie trousers and a white cotton shirt. On her wrists were heavy silver bracelets, and she had tied her hair back in a ponytail. She seemed pensive and taciturn.
"What is it?" he said.
She glanced up.
"I'll be sorry to see you go. I wish..."
All at once she slid from the chair and paced about the room, her fingers stuck in the side pockets of her light blue trousers.
"I want to tell you something, Doctor, but I shouldn't. Maybe someday."
Turning swiftly, she said,
"I think a great deal of you. You're a fine person."
He thought, "She is making it hard for me. Excruciatingly hard. I wonder if I can do it, but there is no alternative that I know of." His clothes had been carefully put up on a shelf of the closet. Now he got them down.
"What are you going to do?"
Loris said, watching him.
"Aren't you going to bed?"
She showed him the pajamas that she had for him.
"No," he said. "I want to be up a while."
After he had dressed, he stood indecisively at the door of the apartment.
"You're so tense," Loris said. "Does it frighten you to be here in the lodge? You're not afraid Helmar will come bursting in, are you?"
Going past him, he smelled the warm fragrance of her hair. She bolted the door to the outer hall.
"Nobody can come in here. This is sacred. The queen's bedroom."
She smiled, showing her regular white teeth.
"Enjoy yourself,"
she said gently, putting her hand on his arm.
"This will be your last time, my dear."
Leaning forward, she kissed him on the mouth with great tenderness.
"I'm sorry," he said, and unbolted the door.
"Where are you going?"
Now her face filled with wariness.
You're going to do something. What is it?
At once she slipped by him, cat-like, barring his passage. Her eyes glowing, she said,
I won't let you go. You want to get revenge on Helmar, do you? Is that it?
She studied him.
No, that's not it. But what can it be?
Putting his hands on her shoulders, he moved her aside. Her powerful, healthy body resisted. For a moment, she tugged at his hands, and then suddenly on her face, comprehension appeared.
Oh, God,
she whispered. The color left her face. The burnished red faded, and he saw, for an instant, the haggard, desolate face of an old woman.
Doctor,
she said,
please don't.
He started to open the door. At once she was on him, her fingers raked at his face, tearing at his flesh, clawing at his eyes. His arm came up instinctively and he flung her backward. She clung to him, pulling him down, dragging at him with the strength and weight of her body. Her white teeth flashed. She bit him frenziedly on the neck. With his other arm, he struck her across the face and she dropped away, gasping hoarsely. Rapidly, he stepped out of the apartment into the hall.
Stop!
She snarled, coming after him. From her shirt, she tugged something, a slender metal tube. He saw it, and then he lashed out. His fist caught her on the side of the jaw, but she avoided the force of the blow. Her eyes glazed with pain, but she did not fall. The tube wavered, and he grabbed at it. Instantly, she yanked back, away from him. He saw the tube pointed at him, and the look on her face, the suffering. Raising her hand, drawing it back, she flung the tube at him, sobbing. The tube fell to the floor near his feet and rolled away.
God damn you,
she moaned, covering her face with her hands. She turned away, her back to him. He saw the convulsions that racked her.
Go on,
she cried, again turning toward him, tears spilling down her cheeks. Swiftly, he ran down the hall, the way they had come. He came out onto the darkened courtyard. There, dimly, he saw the outline of the metal ship. As quickly as possible, he entered it, slammed and locked the door. Could he operate it? Seating himself, he inspected the dials. Then, summoning his memory, he clicked on a toggle switch. The machinery hummed. Dials swung to register. He closed a switch and then, hesitating, pressed a button. A dial showed that he had gone back half an hour in time. That gave him half an hour to make a thorough study of the dials, to recover his earlier knowledge. Calming himself, he began his scrutiny. At a period of 1.5 days in the past, he stopped the mechanism. With caution, he unlocked the door of the ship and swung it open. No one was in sight. Stepping out, he made his way across the courtyard. He swung up onto a balcony and stood, pondering. First, he had to get one of Korath's arrows. Down beneath the ground, in the first subsurface level, he would find the workroom in which Korath had constructed his costume. But did the arrows still exist there? A few were far back in the past, at Nova Albion. One, which he had pulled from Korath's chest, was here somewhere in the lodge, unless it had been destroyed. Did Korath die the second time from the same arrow? Now he remembered. That arrow had been disassembled. He had removed the flint head, the feathers, to analyze them. So his second death could not have come from that arrow. It had to be one of the others. And that second arrow was not, like the first, removed. At least, not to his knowledge. The time was evidently quite late at night, almost morning. The halls artificially lighted seemed deserted. With infinite caution, he made his way down to the first subsurface level. For an hour, he searched in vain for one of Korath's arrows. At last, he gave up. Now the clocks on the walls of the various chambers read 5:30. The lodge would soon be awake. He had no choice but to go back into the past for the arrow. Returning to the timeship, he locked himself inside and again seated himself at the controls. This time, he sent himself and the ship back 35 years, before Loris's birth, before either she or Helmar existed, and he hoped, before Korath left for his ill-fated encounter in the far past. Again, he had arrived late at night,
He had no difficulty locating the lodge's subsurface work area of that period, its machine stops. But Corith's workroom was, of course, securely locked. It took skillful use of the time ship before he located a moment at which he could enter. But he at last found such a moment. The door of the workroom hung open, and no one was inside. In need of a particular tool, Corith had gone off. He caught a glimpse of the man leaving, and an inspection of the near future showed that he would not return for at least 2 hours. Entering, he found half-finished costumes here and there, and on a workbench, the buffalo head. Pigments, photographs of the Indian tribes of the past. He roamed about examining everything. There, by a lathe, he found 3 arrows. Only one had its flint head in place. With an odd feeling, he picked up a chisel that Corith had been using. And here was the raw flint, too. Entering, he found half-finished costumes here and there, and on a workbench, the buffalo head. Pigments, photographs of the Indian tribes of the past. He roamed about examining everything. There, by a lathe, he found 3 arrows. Only one had its flint head in place. With an odd feeling, he picked up a chisel that Corith had been using. And here was the raw flint, too. He noticed the textbook on Stone Age artifacts that Corith had employed as his guide. The heavy book was propped up against the wall, held open with a block of wood. The book, written in English, had been pilfered from the library of the University of California. It was due back on March 12, 1938, and after that, the borrower would be fined. Instead of the one finished arrow, he selected one in process, reasoning that Corith would not as readily notice its absence. By scrutinizing the book and the finished arrows, he was able to see how the flint and the feathers were secured in place. Seating himself at the bench, he finished making the arrow. It took him well over an hour. "I wonder if I've done as good a job as Corith," he asked himself. Taking his completed arrow, he cautiously left the workroom and made his way from the subsurface level up the ramp and along the corridors to the time ship. Again, no one saw him. He reached the ship safely and re-entered. And now he thought there was nothing more, only the act itself. Can I do it? I have to, he realized. I already have done it. With precision, he selected the exact time, the period in which Corith lay recuperating from the operating which Parsons himself had performed. Again and again, he checked the settings of his dials. If he made an error at this point. But he knew, with leaden hopelessness, that he would not, had not, made an error. Wrapping the arrow, he placed it inside his shirt. This trip, he had to move in space as well as time. The room in which Corith lay was well guarded. He could not get in without being noticed and recognized. Of course, the guards would admit him, but later they would remember. He had to emerge within the room itself, close by the patient's bed. Now, with equal precision, he began setting the controls that would relocate the ship in space. A nexus of the two, time and space, a point on the graph. The control board hummed, dials registered, and then the self-regulating banks of equipment clicked off. The trip had ended. According to the indicators, he had arrived. At once he flung open the door of the time ship, a room familiar with white walls. To his left, a bed on which lay a man, a dark-faced man with powerful features, eyes shut. He had succeeded. Going to the bed, Parsons bent down. He had only seconds. He could not pause. Now he brought out the arrow and stripped the wrappings from it. On the bed, the man breathed shallowly. His large, strong hands lay at his sides. Copper against the white of the sheets, his thick black hair spilled down over the pillow. Again, Parsons thought, as if once was not enough, for both of us. Shaking, he raised the arrow back, gripping its shaft with both hands. Can I penetrate the ribs this way? He asked himself. Yes. the soft, vulnerable area around the heart. He had laid it open in order to perform the operation. Good God, he realized with horror. He had to drive the arrow into that spot, into the newly stitched tissue that he had only a short while ago repaired. The sardonic irony. Before him, Corith's eyes fluttered. His breathing changed, and as Parson stood holding the arrow, Corith opened his eyes. He gazed up at Parson's. The eyes, empty, saw nothing at first, and then, imperceptibly, consciousness came. The slack lines of the man's tired face altered, gained force. Parson started to bring the arrow down, but his hand wobbled. He had to draw the arrow back once again to start over. Now the dark eyes fixed themselves on him. The man's mouth opened. The lips drew back as Corith tried to speak. After 35 years, Parsons thought, to come back to life for this. Corith lifted his hand from the sheet, raising it an inch and then letting it fall back.
You, once more, Corith whispered. I'm sorry, Parsons said.
There was comprehension in the dark eyes. He seemed aware of the arrow. Again, he put up his hand, as if reaching for it. But he did not take his eyes from Parsons. Faintly, he said,
You've been against me from the start.
The frail chest heaved beneath the sheet,
spying on me as I worked, lying to me, pretending to be on my side.
Now the weak, trembling hands touched the arrow and then fell away. Consciousness ebbed. He gazed at Parsons wonderingly, with the vacant, troubled gaze of a child.
I can't do it, Parsons realized.
My entire life, everything that I've ever been and stand for, prohibits me. Even if it means my own death. Even though when this man awakens, he will name me, point me out, get his fanatic, paranoid revenge. Parsons lowered the arrow and then dropped it to the floor away from the bed. He felt utter, numbing fear and defeat. So now this man can go on, he thought. Standing by the bed, looking down at Corith, he thought, there is nothing to stop him. A madman. He will destroy me first, and then go on to the rest of his enemies. But I still can't do it. Turning from the bed, he walked unsteadily back to the time ship, entered and bolted the door after him. But there's no safety in here, he realized. Snapping on the bank of controls, he moved the ship ahead in time 2 hours. 2 hours or 2,000 years. It made no difference. Not with Corith alive. Not for that other, earlier Parsons, sitting with Loris, waiting for his patient to regain consciousness. Now the past can unravel. Now the new chain of cause and effect can begin. Starting from that moment at the bed, when I failed to drive the arrow into the man's chest, when I let him live, a whole new world built up from that moment on. Unwinding, carrying itself forward with its own dynamic force. Shutting off the controls of the time ship, he stood hesitantly at the door.
Shall I see?
He asked himself. Corith regaining consciousness, his wife and son and daughter and mother around him, and myself there too. All of us pleased, gratified, bending to hear his every word. Can I watch? Strange that he was still here. He had expected the change to set in at once, as soon as he moved away from the bed. Now he had to look without delay. Tearing open the door of the time ship, he peered out at a scene that he had lived through once before. People at the bedside, their backs to him, paying no attention to him. The elaborate machinery of the lodge's soul cube. The pumps that activated the cold pack. Already they had gotten Corith back into the cold pack. He saw their grief-stricken faces, and then the man himself, drifting in the familiar medium. The arrow, as before, projected from his chest.
Instantly, Parsons slammed the door of the time ship. He punched dials and sent the ship randomly into time, away from the scene. Had they noticed him? Evidently not. The room had been chaotic with activity, men coming and leaving, and himself. He had seen himself standing by the soul cube with Loris, both of them lost in the shock of the moment. Neither of them able to understand or explain, or even accept what had happened. He felt that way now. Shaken, he sat at the controls.
So it was not I, he realized. I didn't kill him. Someone else did the second time. But who? He had to go back to see. After he had left the room, gone back into his time ship, someone else had arrived.
Loris? But she had been with him during that period. They had been together when Helmar brought the news. Helmar? If Korth returned to life, Helmar would be supplanted. For the first time in his life, his potent father returning, and Korth would easily dominate the wolf tribe. Helmar would shrink to nothing. Or, step by step, he began methodically setting the controls of the time ship. Who would he see when he opened the door? He steeled himself against the sight. Calculating down to seconds, he brought the ship to a point in time immediately following the moment at which he had left. There would be no gaps. He would be present during the whole sequence. It must have happened almost at once, he decided. As soon as I left, someone else came in. Someone opened the door of the room and slipped inside. Possibly they saw me. He or she was waiting for me to leave. Throwing the controls to off, he jumped to his feet, ran to the door of the ship and opened it, looked out into the room. At the bed, two figures stood, a man and a woman, bending over the prone figure of Korth. The man's arm flashed up. It came down and the act had been accomplished. Swiftly, the man and the woman retreated from the bed, silently, already in flight. They wasted no time. Their movements were expert and orderly. Obviously, every step had been well planned long in advance. Their tense, strained faces confronted him as they turned. He had never seen either of them before. Both the man and the woman were total strangers to him. They were young, no more than 18 or 19, with firm, smooth faces, skin almost as light as his own. The woman's hair was wheat-colored, her eyes blue. The man, somewhat darker, had heavier brows and almost black hair, but both of them had the same finely made cheekbones and molded jaw lines. He saw the resemblance between them, the spark, the alertness and clarity in their gaze, the high order of intelligence. The woman, or girl, reminded him of Loris. She had Loris's carriage, her well-made shoulders and hips, and the man also had familiar lines in his body.
Hello, the girl said.
Both of them wore the gray robes of the wolf tribe, but not the emblem. On their breasts, a new emblem stood out. Crossed snakes twining up a staff topped by open wings. The caduceus, the ancient sign of the medical profession. The boy said,
Doctor, we should get out of here at once. Will you let my sister go in your ship?
He pointed. And Parsons saw, beside his own ship, a second identical metallic sphere with its door hanging open.
We'll meet ahead in time. Grace knows the point.
He smiled briefly at Parsons as he raced past him and into his own ship. The door shut and the ship at once vanished.
Please, Doctor,
the girl said, touching his arm.
Will you let me operate the controls? I can do it more quickly rather than telling you.
She had already started into his ship. He followed mutely, letting her shut the door after them. After a pause, Parsons said,
How is your mother?
You'll be seeing her, the girl said. She's fine.
Parsons said, You're Loris's children from the future.
Your children too, the girl said. Your son and daughter.